Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Dr. Drew Weston, who's an author and professor of psychology at Emory University. His just published book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation, a book that argues that the Democrats need to take a leaf out of the Republicans' playbook in terms of public relations. And, of course, despite President Bush's unpopularity, he appears to have successfully created a public relations surge in advance of Monday's so-called Petraeus report. And we were looking into how the Democrats were suckered into basically supporting the Petraeus report, which, of course, is, in a sense, the Bush report. And then we speak with Michael Scheuer, who is a 22-year veteran, former CIA analyst, who was, until his resignation, the CIA's chief expert on bin Laden. He's the author of the bestseller Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama bin Laden, Radical Islam and the Future of America. His new book is Marching Towards Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. And Michael Scheuer was mentioned by Osama bin Laden in the tape that was released last Friday. And so we'll be looking into what it's like to have your book endorsed by the world's most wanted terrorist. And then we'll speak with David Enders, who's a 26-year-old freelance journalist and the co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin, the first post-invasion attempt to set up an English language news outlet in Iraq. Since the invasion, he has spent more than 18 months in Iraq and has written for Mother Jones, The Nation, and as well as London Sunday Times and other newspapers. His first book, Baghdad Bulletin, was recently published by the University of Michigan Press, and David Enders has been blogging on his experiences in Iraq at the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting's website as a part of their Iraq project. I'm now speaking with Drew Weston, who's an author and professor of psychology at Emory University. His just published book is The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation, which Howard Dean said is the political brain. Drew Weston has created a must-read. We will win the presidency if our candidates read and act on this book. How about winning the battle in the Congress, Dr. Weston? How do you explain how President Bush has so successfully, in spite of his unpopularity, done a public relations end run around the Congress? And they thought that Republicans would go back for the August recess and be beaten up by their constituents, but they obviously didn't notice this massive public relations campaign that's been unleashed and by the compliant press, where basically President Bush is telling the world that telling the American people we're winning over there and the surge is working and everything is great. And only belatedly did the Republicans refer to the surge as the Bush-Petraeus surge. Why, from the very beginning, did so many important Democrats jump on the Petraeus bandwagon?
Well, I think they were too scared about losing seats and not worried enough about losing lives. I think the biggest problem with the way the Democrats responded to the president's veto of their war bill back in May was that they accepted the premise that, accepted the phrase "support our troops," that had been carefully crafted by the Bush administration to confuse people on supporting our men and women in military and supporting their deployment in Iraq. Just as they had confused with the term "the war on terror," the war in Iraq with the war against bin Laden. And if you accept the terms of the other side on something like this, you're going to run scared pretty fast, and I think that's exactly what they did.
Well, apparently in the latest Zogby poll, 54% of the nation believes, counter to what Harry Reid has been saying, that the war is not lost in Iraq, and that's twice the support Bush enjoyed for his war leadership, which was a paltry 27%.
But right. Well, this is again, you know, this was something that was completely predictable in May when the Democrats backed down. You know, what they essentially at the time, they didn't want to vote their conscience. They didn't want to vote what they thought was the right thing to do, and they didn't want to vote what the American people had told them what was the right thing to do, because they were afraid that they would be branded as not supporting the troops and as weak on national defense. And you know, they even said as much. Comments to the media about how, well, we don't want to fail to support our troops right before Memorial Day. The problem with that thinking is that it's very concrete. It assumes that what people are listening to is your stand, and that the way to win the center is to take a centrist position, which is sort of, you know, halfway between the left and halfway, you know, halfway between the left and the right. And just from a psychological point of view, what that whole way of strategic thinking really misses is that that what people were listening to was the meta message Democrats were sending. And by that I mean that they're listening to the message that Democrats were really sending, which is that when confronted with a bully standing in his bully pulpit at only, you know, 27-28% of the polls at that point, they backed down. And the real message that the American public got, and we saw a drop in the polls of approval towards the Democrats in Congress of 15 points within the next week. The American people got the message, which was that the Democrats were not standing with their convictions, that they were caving to the president, and that they couldn't be trusted with national security. So it was one of these. It was a Faustian bargain where they said, well, we'll wait for Petraeus and we'll see what Petraeus says. But it was a bad Faustian bargain, both because it was made based on a complete miscalculation of how voters would perceive it. And it was also made on the basis of the idea that somehow General Petraeus would be an impartial arbiter of how things looked after his escalation of several months, which, of course, you can't watch this administration and imagine that it's going to have an impartial report come out by the only general on the ground who left standing, essentially, who's willing to continue having our troops get slaughtered this way.
Well, that's what's extraordinary, is that the Democrats have abandoned their successful 2006 strategy so quickly by endorsing this political general who, back in before the 2004 elections, just 6 weeks before the 2004 elections, in the Washington Post, he claimed that there was tangible progress in Iraq. And you know that it's very rare for serving officers to speak in public. It's almost impossible to get anybody from the Pentagon to say anything worth listening to. You have to wait till they're retired before they tell the truth. So here's a guy putting out this propaganda saying we're making tangible progress in Iraq just before the 2004 elections. He's saying Iraqi security elements are being rebuilt. The Iraqi leadership is stepping forward. There's been real progress and effort to enable Iraqis to shoulder more of the load of their own security. And then a year later, he says there's been enormous progress with the Iraqi security forces. So it's not as if the writing wasn't on the wall. So what's wrong with it? What's wrong with them in the sense that they have within their own ranks a guy called Jim Webb, the senator, who's a Vietnam vet. His son's over there in Iraq. He's been extremely effective in portraying the Democrats as having a more sensible and in a sense patriotic approach to this war, which is to stop the slaughter of our boys and girls over there for no good purpose, not to mention the trillions of dollars that are going south and destroying the American economy and having our competitors laugh at us.
You know, I think it's a great example of two things. I think you're spot on. One of them is the psychology of fear, and that, you know, since 9/11, the Democrats have been running scared in anything that mentions national security or terrorism or war, for fear that we'll get Democrats will get branded as not strong on terror or not strong on national security. And as soon as you find yourself conveying fear as a leader, you're doing the wrong thing at a time when people are scared. Because what people most want to see is a guy like Webb who says, I'm not putting up with anything from you, and I'm not scared by you or Bin Laden. And you know that's how Franklin Roosevelt won hearts and minds, and against a much more frightening foe, Adolf Hitler. You know, he didn't tell people to run around being fearful and watch out for the terrorists. And you know, if the other side, if the Republicans win, you know, then Hitler wins. He didn't do any of that kind of stuff. He told people, you know, calm down, relax. You have nothing to fear but fear itself, and we will beat this enemy, and it's going to take sacrifice, and it's going to take loss of American lives, but we will accomplish it. But he told people not to be afraid. The Democrats instead have really been projecting nothing but fear. I think the other thing is that they keep putting off making the decisions that they need to make because then making decisions like this one with, you know, well, we'll wait for Petraeus to give us the answer, or with the FISA law, we'll revisit this in 6 months. Well, 6 months is going to be in the heat of a presidential contest, and that's the last time that you want to be debating an issue where the Republicans are going to claim that the Democrats are afraid to listen to terrorists chatter, and therefore are once again, you know, weak on terror. So I think the problem is that you really don't want to project fear when people are afraid, and Democrats keep making the same mistake over and over and over again.
But Drew Wesson, it's not just a tactical mistake that they make. It is, in fact, it turns out that invariably when they cave, they actually present the other side, the Republicans, with an electoral gift.
Correct.
It's almost like a political version of the Stockholm syndrome, where you end up rewarding and identifying your torturer. The 2002 October authorization vote, which still haunts Hillary Clinton and haunted Kerry during the campaign, is a perfect example where they had the majority, they controlled the Senate, they owned the Senate Intelligence Committee, so they knew what the real intelligence was, and the leader, the head of that committee, Senator Bob Graham, and the deputy leader Dick Durbin tried to tell all their colleagues that this was all bogus, but then they went ahead and voted to authorize Bush, who then turned around and won the elections because they essentially gave it to him. You just mentioned the wiretap authorization, which they gave him before the summer.
They even gave him the Military Commissions Act in October of 2006 when Democrats were headed for a landslide. They could easily have said, made the case that, you know, we're supposed to be teaching the Iraqis about democracy, not the other way around. You know, if we sign this law that the Republicans want us to sign, then the terrorists have won because they've in fact completely subverted everything that our freedom stands for. Now, how difficult is it to spit those words out? But it seems to be very difficult for risk-averse senators and congressmen who are being guided by the same risk-averse strategists who told them in 2002 to vote against their conscience on the Iraq War resolution, who told them in 2002, in 2004, not to talk about Abu Ghraib and not to talk about the Iraq War because it would just hurt them, and who we all forget told them actually in 2006. The same strategist who got hired and pollsters who got hired over and over and over again after stunning losses in 2002 in the Congress and in both the Congress and the presidency in 2004 told them in early 2006, don't talk about the Iraq War. It'll make us look weak on national security. And fortunately, there were some people like Webb and Joe Sestak who basically gave the party strategist the finger and said, you don't know what you're talking about. I do. I've been there. And those guys won, and this is where I think the Democrats learned the wrong lesson from Jim Webb. The lesson is not, I mean, Jim Webb is a centrist on most issues, but he's not a centrist on this issue. He's taking the far left position on this issue. The thing that I think Democrats are missing the point on Democratic strategists are missing the point on about Webb is, it's not that this isn't a matter of left and right. This is a matter of right and wrong. And the American people can see that, and they can see when you're voting in a way that you don't believe in. And what Jim Webb says very forcefully, and he comes from a state that is a military state and is a state that previously had been pretty pro-Iraq war, he says, listen, I'm a military man, and I'll tell you, I'm not voting to send my son or anybody else's son to stay in Iraq where we shouldn't have gone in the first place. I told the president we shouldn't go there in the first place. It's his toughness. It's his standing up for his convictions. That's what gives him the more than anything else. I think more than his military background, that's what gives him the moral authority to talk about this. And this is again what Democrats need to learn from Webb is that people most prefer someone who shares their particular convictions. But what they prefer next is someone who stands up for his or her convictions. What they do not support are people who look like they will blow with the wind depending on which way the polls are going, and that's or who look like they are guided primarily by fear in the post 9/11 world. And that's what the Democrats keep projecting time after time after time.
Well, you know, you just contrasting Petraeus's giddy optimism, there was an op-ed in the New York Times recently by six sergeants serving over there, all of whom tell what it's like on the ground and how completely dysfunctional and impossible the situation is. So there's a major disconnect between these political generals who are telling the White House what they want to hear, or at least this one particular general, and the people that are on the ground fighting this war. So there's not as if the Democrats don't have a lot of ammunition if they just showed some courage.
Well, the real danger in what they did in May is exactly what has come to roost. And again, it's something that many of us were talking about the day after the vote or the day of the vote, which is what you're gonna allow by doing this is not only are you gonna convey yourselves as the party of cowardice and complicity, which is how the voters responded to them. Again, it was a 15-point drop in the poll for the Democratic Congress immediately within a week after registered a week after their vote to give the president his escalation and to essentially cave in the face of his aggressive response to their responsible bill. But the other thing that was predictable was that we would essentially be presented when they said, well, we'll revisit this with Petraeus, was that it was predictable that we would then be presented with muddied waters, that they were giving Petraeus an authority they should never have given him. And, you know, the fact that they're allowing and holding hearings for Petraeus to be speaking to the country on the week of 9/11, once again confusing 9/11 with the war in Iraq, I just don't know how, at this point, the Democratic leadership cannot have figured out that has been, from the start, the strategy that got us into Iraq. You do not allow them to associate Iraq with bin Laden. And to hold the hearings the week of 9/11, I can't understand the sort of psychological denseness of the Democratic strategists who are behind these moves.
Yeah, just in closing, unfortunately, the only people that seem to stand up against Bush and against this war are conservatives like Buchanan, you know, who I can't say I share anything with. He's quoted in this latest article, incredibly, only 3% of the nation give Congress a positive rating on its handling of the war. Congress has lost the hawks, the owls, and the doves. No one trusts its leadership on the war, and George W. Bush smells it. He no longer fears the power of Congress, and his rhetoric suggests he is contemptuous of it. He is brimming with self-assurance that he can break any Democratic attempt to impose deadlines for troop withdrawal and force Congress to cough up the funds he demands. Confident victory this fall on the Hill, Bush is now moving into phase 3 of his war on terror. First Afghanistan, then Iraq, then next Iran. So,
you know, it's frightening when I suspect you and I both agree with every word that Pat Buchanan has just written.
Right. And then we have to turn to people like Pat Buchanan. It's pretty sad.
The other people we can turn to are people who unfortunately have been marginalized in their own party on this, like Robert Byrd, who spoke against eloquently against the Iraq War resolution, and Ted Kennedy and Russ Feingold, who seem to be three, and now Jim Webb, you know, three or four of the oases of truth in the midst of of just a pool of fear and complicity. It's a sad state when Buchanan and Feingold and Kennedy are in the same camp together, and everybody else seems not to be.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Drew Weston.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Drew Weston. He's an author and professor of psychology at Emory University. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of a Nation. Let's now go to the gentleman whose writing was endorsed by Osama bin Laden. I'm speaking with Michael Scheuer, who was for 22 years a CIA analyst. He was, up until his resignation, the CIA's top expert on Osama bin Laden. He's the author of the bestseller Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America. And his new book is Marching Towards Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. And Michael Scheuer was mentioned by Osama bin Laden in the videotape that was released last Friday. And, of course, this is the first tape since his last tape, which came on the eve of the 2004 elections and were largely considered by many, Michael Scheuer, to have helped President Bush and hurt John Kerry. It's odd that in his latest tape, bin Laden would say, "You permitted Bush to complete his first term, and stranger still, chose him for a second term, which gave him a clear mandate from you, with your full knowledge and consent, to continue to murder our people in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then you claim to be innocent. The innocence of yours is like my innocence of the blood of your sons on the 11th, which I too, were I to claim such a thing." You've spent, I wouldn't say a lifetime, but a considerable amount of time studying this man. That seems like an extraordinary inconsistency or denial on his part. So can you give us some insight into that apparent inconsistency, that on the one hand he appears to have helped President Bush, and arguably President Bush has helped him, and now he's proclaiming that the American people should never have reelected this man?
Well, I think there's less of an inconsistency, perhaps, than it seems. There is no better person than President Bush, insofar as Al-Qaeda is concerned, for his policies, certainly, but even more for his rhetoric. President Bush does, puts everything very starkly, reinforces the negative themes that bin Laden has laid out regarding American policy in the Middle East. But at the same time, even in the speech of 2004, it may have helped President Bush, but the bottom line in the speech was, you can elect Bush, you can elect Kerry, you can elect the devil himself. I don't care. What we want to do is to change your policies. And I think what he's saying in the speech this week was simply that you decided to keep the status quo, and therefore you're as fully responsible for what's happening in the Muslim world as President Bush.
But in a way, it seems to me that it is President Bush who has elevated bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage from the very beginning. I mean, he's not, he's almost treated like a superpower, in the sense that he's fighting the superpower. So why did we, from the very beginning, cede so much to this man?
Well, first, because he's a great historical figure. I don't think we ceded so much. I think it's a very dangerous thing to believe that we created this individual. This is a remarkable man in terms of his talents, his personal courage, his piety, his a willingness to give up the life of a billionaire to live in Afghanistan. He may not have any positive consequences for us, but the current vogue of deriding him as, you know, some kind of a minor player, what that conduces to at the final point is that this two-bit bit player that you made is now defeating you around the world in every place you're fighting. So I think it's a mistake to make this man out to be some sort of a cipher in the general scheme of things.
But Michael Scheuer, I mean, the jihadis already believe they brought down the evil empire through their resistance in Afghanistan, and I think it's pretty clear that we've lost in Iraq and losing in Afghanistan, and surely they will therefore believe they've defeated both superpowers. And I think you could make a stronger case that we have defeated ourselves ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan by not employing our soft power and by the immature and impetuous use of our hard power that's undermined the very deterrent power that the United States has.
Well, I would say a couple of things to that. First, that I believe that soft power is a farce. Soft power is only useful after you've annihilated the enemy. Soft power during the Cold War would have been useless if the Soviets didn't believe that we would have responded to whatever they did in whatever measure they used. So the whole business with that professor at Harvard and this whole soft power thing is I think, wrong. I also think that although the use of the military in Iraq was certainly impulsive, it was also dainty. If anyone believes that the American military has delivered anything remotely approaching the full capacity of its power to annihilate, then they're sadly mistaken, I hope. But the third thing is I would entirely agree with you. We have facilitated the ongoing victories of Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, their movement, and the people they inspire, without a doubt. But that's not because they're weak to the point of being unable to do things on their own, or that they're not very well led, or that they're not smart. It's simply that we're terminally lacking, and I'm afraid, in moral courage to talk about the causes of this war and why the enemy is so resilient and powerful. So I entirely agree with you. They cannot defeat us, but we are entirely defeating ourselves at the moment.
Well, I suppose deterrence is not the use of power; it's the potential use of power. And if you use power and it backfires or it doesn't work, then it's a major self-inflicted wound. Look what happened with the Israelis last summer against Hezbollah.
Oh, I think that's exactly right, and that's the point I perhaps tried to make not very articulately. If you're going to use your power, use it. If you're not going to use it, don't use it at all. Deliver catastrophe to whoever you're about to undertake military power against, especially in the case of the terrorists, because they're so hard to deter. What you need to establish is a deterrent that will make people think twice about supporting them indirectly.
Well, we almost did that in Afghanistan as a response to 9/11. That's the part that is so frustrating, that bin Laden has been given more lives than a cat.
Absolutely, sir. And I think there's a little bit here still of a historical anomaly. I think our leaders, and sadly with their views on foreign policies across both parties, are still suffering from kind of a Cold War hangover. They talk the good talk about fighting Al-Qaeda and its allies, the non-state threats, but in their heart of hearts, they're either deceiving us or themselves, because they don't take this threat seriously. None of them do. Their big worries are still nation states, whether it's China or Russia or North Korea or Iran. And I don't know how long it's going to take us to grow out of this Cold War mindset, but it's killing us at the moment.
And that's best exemplified by Donald Rumsfeld, who was jealous of the fact that the CIA were first in on the ground in Afghanistan, and he didn't really have any useful war plans. And George Tenet suddenly became popular at the White House, and he was at that point said something to the effect that, why bomb Afghanistan? There are no good targets.
Yeah, they just don't understand, and I think that's endemic across the military, although I think the Marine Corps is getting a much greater familiarity with reality since they've been out in Anbar for over a year now. It's also very apparent in the fact that we have delegated responsibility for protecting America to a third world dictator. We still think it's the Cold War. We still think we have proxies out there who will do our bidding, and it's not the case.
And this, you're referring to Musharraf?
I am referring to Musharraf, yes, sir.
And Musharraf's prosecution of going after bin Laden and at the same time supporting the Taliban is a little two-faced, to put it mildly. I mean, how naive can we be?
Well, the naivete doesn't come from that. I think what Musharraf is doing is entirely realistic and in the interests of his country. The naivete is on our part to think that everyone else's national interests are identical with ours. Virtually nothing Musharraf has done to help us since 2001 has been in the interest of Pakistan. It's a remarkable amount of assistance that he's rendered to us, but we still want more and more and more. We've driven that country now to the brink of civil war, and now we want to put the kleptocracy of either Nawaz Sharif or Benazir Bhutto back in power. So it's very hard. Where I see the naivety or the plain ignorance is in Washington, not in Islamabad. If the Americans were my ally, I would be hedging my bets.
And do you believe that that it is as difficult as they're claiming to find bin Laden in that territory?
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely that difficult, but not impossible. What's made it impossible, sir, is we've tried to do Afghanistan on the cheap. We have about 30,000, 34,000 American troops there, and they're supposed to rebuild the economy, create a democracy, keep President Karzai in power, defeat the Taliban insurgency, eradicate the opium industry, and in their spare time get bin Laden and Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda. And this country has the highest mountains on earth, and it's bigger than Texas. Usually when you try to do things on the cheap, it ends up biting you in the neck, and that's exactly what's happening in Afghanistan.
Well, just to quote from your title of your book, Imperial Hubris, we were very, the Bush administration were incredibly hubristic in the first place. They basically gave NATO the back of their hand, and then after they got in trouble in Afghanistan, they then begged NATO, and NATO stepped up. I believe the Canadians were first to recognize the malignancy of the opium trade. They went to Karzai. Karzai's brother is big in the opium trade. So it seems to me that we're falling for that idea of a figurehead, just as we're everybody's now invested so much in the Petraeus report, the idea that the man on the white horse will rescue us. It seems to me that we have this ludicrous investment in Karzai, who, as far as I can tell, is pretty much just the mayor of Kabul.
Yeah, he's about as much an Afghan as I am. You know, he stayed out of the fighting during the war against the Soviets. He has really no tribal basis except nominally. He's sort of a nominal Muslim. His allies are always the mortal enemies of his tribal brothers, if you will. So he speaks English. He dresses well. He keeps his hair cut. It's the kind of person we support, whether or not they have any influence or capacity for growth.
And what about his brother being the bagman for the drug trade?
I don't know that for certain, sir, but it seems to me that it's possible. Mm-hmm. The problem is that Mr. Rumsfeld, when we were preparing to go to Afghanistan, there was any number of heroin factories, for the want of a better word, on the target list, and he took them off. Prime Minister Blair from Britain remonstrated with Mr. Bush to say, listen, most of our street crime comes from Afghan heroin connections. We need to destroy that industry. And President Bush backed Rumsfeld.
Why? So, why, though? Why, Michael Chu?
Rumsfeld thought it was not the duty of the military, as far as I understand, to attack those sites, that's not really the military's job. But there was plenty of targets in Afghanistan that are involved in supporting the insurgency now. If Rumsfeld had a problem finding targets, then he was kind of dopier than I thought.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Michael Scheuer, that bin Laden is a great man, and of course that will come as a shock to a number of people because he has been so thoroughly demonized, and I guess what you're saying is that by demonizing this man, you fail to see who he is and what we're up against. But the bottom line here is that the president keeps saying they hate us for our values, our democracy. They hate us for who we are rather than what we do. And clearly you're saying that they hate us because of what we do.
Yes, and I think that's why bin Laden referred to my books, because I've simply tried to lay out for Americans what he said and asked them to think for themselves for a change, to stop listening to this nonsense about wars, about gender equality and primary elections and liberties and all of that stuff. and listen to what the opposition says they're fighting about. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to accept it. It doesn't mean you have to sympathize or empathize with it. But you're not going to be able to defeat an enemy you don't understand. And I think we're proving that in spades at the moment. But, of course, since Bin Laden spoke, the pro-Israeli blogs and the right-wing blogs, of course, have undertaken a pretty thoroughgoing defaming exercise on me. So I don't think I'm going to be able to serve as any kind of a
But you're in
spotlight.
You're in pretty good company. They did the same with Jimmy Carter and with the Walton Mearsheimer book. There seems to be a concerted effort to avoid a debate or to basically sanctify the status quo. And anybody with half a brain can see that the status quo of a U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is not working.
No, you can see it's a disaster, sir, and has been a disaster for the better part of 30 years. But you're exactly right. They don't want to talk about energy. Because they failed for 35 years, both parties, to get us anywhere close to self-sufficiency. They don't want to talk about Israel because that's a martyrdom operation for any American politician, and it denies them immense amounts of campaign money. And because they won't do anything about oil, they don't want to talk about the fact that America is now the supporter of probably the biggest number of the worst police states in the world today, in the Middle East, in the Arab world. So it's much easier to lie to the American people and kind of get them viscerally upset. Your daughter's going to have to wear a burqa. Your son is going to have to learn how to drive a suicide truck, crap like that, rather than talking to the American people about the truth. And the media has been complicit. The media has not given Americans an opportunity to read what the enemy has said. Not because they'll agree with it, they'll probably hate them all the more for it, but simply so they can make their own determination about who's telling the truth and who's not.
But, of course, the situation vis-a-vis Israel's security has deteriorated dramatically, it seems, as a result of our intervention, our failed intervention in Iraq.
Without question, sir. You know, it's a tragedy, but there's almost a sort of biblical justice, a delicious irony in the fact that men who guided our policy into Iraq, many of them put Israeli security first over America's, and they thought by taking down Saddam they were going to make Israel more secure. Now Israel has never been less secure, probably since the 67 war at least, and it doesn't look like it can get any better. Why do you think Senator Lieberman is so wants to stay in Iraq so badly? I doubt it has anything to do with American interests.
But at the end of the day, if on the present course we're in, given that Israel's security rests in large part on the two treaties that they have that protect them with Jordan and with Egypt, there's a real chance that the spillover from the Iraq war will destabilize the kingdom of Jordan. And there's a very real chance that the Muslim Brotherhood will eventually take over in Egypt. If in the last election they would have won, but for the vote rigging that Mubarak was engaged in.
I think you're absolutely correct, sir. And I think that the whatever talent there is in the American intelligence community, and people can argue whether there's a lot or not about the Arab world and the Muslim world as a whole. But I'll tell you, even the most junior-level officer would have told this administration that if you go to Iraq and you don't win hands down completely, you sign Jordan's death warrant. And I think you're exactly right. Jordan is not tomorrow or the next day, but certainly in the future, and especially when we leave, Jordan is gone as a partner for any kind of a peace process.
So the Israelis will have jihadis on their border.
Absolutely. The Israelis will get what most people get when they pursue an unyielding maximalist policy, and that ends up to be disaster. They've also had the thing that occurs to me, and, you know, they're as smart as, probably a lot smarter than I am, but the American support for Israel has never cost America anything but money, and now it's costing us lives. And I think when that begins to take root in the intellect and in the thought of American people outside of Washington and New York, they're going to say, why should we die why should our kids die for this faraway country in which we have no real national security interest?
Given the political realities, there's no way the United States is going to abandon Israel. So what would you recommend?
Well, as long as the whole issue, Mr. Masters, remains the play toy of the governing elite, as long as the Democrats and the Republicans can squash any discussion of our relationship with Israel, what it's costing now and what it's going to cost in terms of our young men and women in the future, I agree with you. But I think bin Laden and his movement are going to have a great impact on how Americans perceive their so-called duty to protect Israel and other countries around the world, the Saudis, the Jordanians, and the rest of them.
So that puts us in a kind of Fort Apache mentality, where we're supporting a country under siege and unpopular kings equally under siege.
We're supporting a bunch of countries that are unimportant to us in the post-Cold War world, certainly except in every way except for oil. Had the American political establishment begun to do something in 1973 when our good friends the Saudis put the first embargo on us, we would be 35 years down the trail toward some sort of an ability to decide our own future. You know, leaving the Islamist thing aside, Mr. Masters, we have probably the most important attribute of independence is an ability to decide if or when you're going to go to war or if you're not going to go to war. But today, if something would happen in the Eastern Kingdom, in the Eastern province of Saudi Arabia, rather, to disrupt oil, we would go to war to protect that. In an entirely non-Islamic situation, if something happened in the Gulf of Guinea, in the Niger Delta, Americans would go to war immediately, without any question, without even any choice, to protect that oil production. So we frittered away much of our independence over the last 35 years.
Well, Mike Shore, I could continue this on for much longer, but we've run out of time, and I appreciate your joining us today in Los Angeles.
You're very kind to me, sir. I'm always glad to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Michael Choi, who is a 22-year veteran, former CIA analyst, who was, until his resignation, the CIA's top expert on bin Laden. He's the author, as anonymous, of the bestseller Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama bin Laden, Radical Islam and the Future of America. His forthcoming book is Marching Towards Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. And of course, Michael Shaw was mentioned by Osama bin Laden in the tape that was released last Friday. I'm speaking now with David Enders, who's a 26-year-old freelance journalist and co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin, his first post-invasion attempt to set up an English-language news outlet in Iraq. Since the invasion of Iraq, he has spent more than 18 months in Iraq and has written for Mother Jones, The Nation, as well as London Sunday Times and other newspapers. His first book, Baghdad Bulletin, was recently published by the University of Michigan Press, and David Enders has been blogging on his experience in Iraq at the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting's website as part of their Iraq project. And we spoke, I think, about a month and a half ago, David, when you were in Basra visiting with the governor in that little sort of cocoon that had been set up. And since then, of course, the British have largely withdrawn, and most people are seeing that as a sort of the test case for what would happen if the United States withdraws. And of course, great public relations efforts have been made to sell this surge in advance of the Monday's release of the report by General Petraeus. We spoke earlier with Drew Weston, who's written a book about the political brain and why Republicans seem to do end runs around Democrats and much better at capturing the rhetorical high ground, if you will. What do you expect to happen this week, given that this very political general has been so successful at telling us that we're winning in Iraq?
Well, I expect more of the same. Optimistic assessments from the military and I don't think there's really any reason to expect anything different. Petraeus's letter to troops in Iraq was released a couple days ago, and I think probably the key phrase was, we have the ball and we're driving down the field. And football analogies aside, I think the military has consistently at every turn, oh, just give us another month. Just give us another couple months. Just give us a little more time. We're going to get this solved. We're going to get this worked out. And it's kind of their job to say that, I think. I don't think any military commander serving at the pleasure of the Bush administration is expected to say, well, you know what, time to pack up. We don't have a chance. There's no definition of victory that's workable, and we need to pull the troops out.
But I believe that happened in private with Abizaid and Casey, didn't it?
Right, and now you've got Petraeus. So that's what happens, and then you get another commander. They find someone who's willing to go ahead and continue.
So you've been there for over 18 months since the invasion, and when we last spoke, you gave a very different picture from the one that the drumbeat of the White House is doing in advance of this Petraeus report. And recently in the New York Times, there were six sergeants serving in Iraq, wrote about their experiences on the ground, which, of course, fly in the face of all this optimism. What do you think the problem is with the American people? Is it just that the lone superpower can't get its head around the idea that we've already been beaten?
You know, that's a question I ask my friends, and my friends ask me frequently, and it's hard to really say exactly what the problem is. I couldn't really tell you. There are a lot of Americans who still think that we won in Vietnam, which was something I didn't realize until a couple years ago.
Well, that's been the revisionist history. We won all the battles but lost the war.
Exactly. And I think that's you know, the way a lot of Americans see. A lot of Americans honestly seem to believe this notion, and a lot of people within the military honestly seem to believe this notion that if we don't fight them there, we're going to fight them at home, which is incorrect. But that line seems to really ring true with a lot of soldiers and a lot of people who sort of support the war. And I think it comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of the world, or I guess an inability. You know that statistic that so many Americans, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's like half of Americans don't have a passport or have never left the United States. I got into an argument a couple weeks ago on a radio show in St. Louis, and there were some soldiers calling up, and they were saying, you know, how can the Iraqis not appreciate us being there? Saddam was feeding people into a wood chipper, you know? Like, don't they get that we freed them from this? And no, they don't get that we freed them from this, because we didn't. You know, this inability to understand that no Iraqis believe that the U.S. went to Iraq or invaded Iraq out of altruistic reasons, and that from an Iraqi standpoint, Saddam feeding people into a wood chipper isn't a whole lot different from American soldiers firing at random because a car gets too close to their convoy or their checkpoint, or now Medi Army militiamen drilling holes in people's heads and torturing them and leaving bodies on garbage dumps. There's still lots of dead bodies, whoever is responsible for them. And Americans seem to have a real hard time. They also do just genuinely seem to have a real hard time picturing other Americans, I guess, as killers or as capable of doing some of these things. I think, and when you look at, for instance, the American prison system and other aspects of American culture, it's maybe not so surprising, but people really do have a hard time, I think you're right, getting their head around this.
Well, I suppose one of the excuses for not facing the reality of how, one, we should never have gone in the first place, two, we've rewarded and emboldened an even greater enemy in the sense of Iran, and three, we've possibly destabilized the entire region. Which Michael Shoah was mentioning, that any analyst would know that at the end of the day, the Sunni redoubt, the defeated Sunni, given the numerical superiority of the Shia, will eventually destabilize Jordan, which is pretty much on the cards. So I guess the excuse that's been offered is that there'll be even worse bloodbath if we pull out.
Well, right now the effect of the surge, I think quite clearly, has been to slow down said bloodbath slightly with stopgap solutions like building walls around particular neighborhoods or literally arming the other side. And the violence has slowed a bit, but it's still continuing in parts of the country that haven't received more U.S. soldiers. And the military itself has admitted that it can't maintain the current troop levels that it has in there now. So that bloodbath is going to occur whether or not we're driven out militarily or whether we leave voluntarily, because essentially what's going to happen is people are just going to get more and more impatient, and they will start fighting us again. And certainly there are still a lot of Iraqis now from both sides again, Sunni and Shiite militias, fighting the U.S.
Well, what is it that...
If one of them is our proxy, it doesn't really make a difference.
Right. But since you spent quite a lot of time there, David Endes, what is the... It does appear that the die is cast, that these people are really going to start slaughtering each other, and they just want us to get out of the way, and they want to get on with it. But I don't understand that impulse of fratricide. I understand that the Shia under Saddam were brutalized and want revenge, etc. But I still don't get it. Can you fill us in a bit on what drives this fratricide?
Well, Iraq, politically, Iraq for decades has been a country of absolutes. Saddam Hussein ruled with, Chris Hedges wrote the line recently that the glue of modern Iraq was the secret police force, that was what held it together, and that was really true. And you maintain such a repressive regime by having absolute authority. You can't have democracy and maintain such a repressive regime. The impulse toward fratricide is the impulse toward entirely securing things. The way political Shiite extremists and Shiite militias are looking at this is never again. Now is our chance. If we do this now, if we take Baghdad, if we drive anyone who is potentially against us out now, we prevent Saddam from ever coming back. We prevent the Baath from ever coming back. We prevent these new Sunni extremists from reestablishing themselves. That it's just a game of absolutes at this point. And there's also an element of power to it. Certainly these militia commanders, some of them are very bad people, and the impulse to, you know, expel everyone from a different sect out of a neighborhood so that you can move your own people. And that's how Saddam did things. Mm. You're having people who have experienced generations of displacement now coming back and seeing that as the only possible way. And not only are you seeing it with Sunnis and Shiites, the Kurds are increasingly impatient for the U.S. to get out of their way so they can take over Kirkuk, which means more ethnic cleansing, which means the kicking of Arabs out of Kirkuk. And so...
Well, it's just in closing then, David Endes, I guess it's pretty clear that the Shia have the numbers and they've got the discipline and the support of Iran. So what happens to the Sunni when they're defeated?
It looks increasingly like they get a rump state, as it's been called, in Anbar, or they turn to Saudi Arabia, to Jordan, to the U.S., as they are now, for weapons and money and support to continue fighting the Shiites.
And so this agony could go on long after we've sort of slinked out of there, if indeed we have enough sense to do that.
And, you know, the hope is that Iran and Saudi Arabia don't want to fight a proxy war inside Iraq that badly. That the regional powers, once the U.S. is out of the way, will reach some sort of working agreement that spares lives rather than continues to take them.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, David Enderson. We should stay in touch.
Thanks for having
me. Are you going back, by the way?
Not in the short term.
All right. Well, let's stay in touch. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with David Enders, 26-year-old freelance journalist and co-founder of the Baghdad Bulletin. And he has been in Iraq since the invasion for more than 18 months and gives a very different point of view from a lot of the reporting that we hear from Iraq. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, and Lick Duan, the assistant producers, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org.